Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Mario Ritter, Bruce Albert, and Phil Dierking. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will bring us America's Presidents. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
Research subjects who have lived with limited human contact since January recently completed an experiment. The six, four men and two women, live near the top of a volcano on the Pacific island of Hawaii. They agreed to stay in a small restricted area as part of a study to learn about the mental and emotional effects of a long-term space mission. The six people lived and acted much like astronauts would on an 8-month-long visit to the planet Mars. The American Space Agency, NASA, provided money for the experiment. Information gathered in the study will help NASA choose individuals and groups with the right qualities for a trip to Mars. Individuals who are able to deal with long-term space travel need to have special qualities or traits. They need to be able to deal well with isolation, pressure, and danger for up to 3 years on a trip that would take them far from Earth. The six research subjects were isolated from other people on a large flat plain near the top of Mauna Loa, the world's largest active volcano. The area is about 2,400 meters above sea level and has thin, dry air. During the experiment, the subjects wore spacesuits like those worn by astronauts and traveled in teams whenever leaving their living structure. Researchers called the dome-shaped living space a habitat. It is about the size of a small house. The kinds of food available to the research subjects were limited. They ate mostly freeze-dried or canned food during the experiment. All communications between the crew members and outsiders were given a 20-minute delay, increasing the sense of isolation. 20 minutes is the time it takes a radio signal to travel from Mars to Earth. The mission was the fifth in a series of six NASA-financed studies at the University of Hawaii Habitat. It is called the Space Exploration Analog and Simulation, or High Seas. Laura Lark was the team's information technology specialist. She thinks a manned flight to Mars is a reasonable goal for NASA. Lark described the project in a video message recorded in the dome. There are certainly human factors to be figured out. That's part of what High Seas is for, she said. But I think that overcoming those challenges is just a matter of effort. We are absolutely capable of it. In the experiment, researchers used games to study human behavior. The crew members played games designed to measure their ability to work together. Games also helped measure their ability to deal with pressure or stress. The crew members also kept documentation of how they were feeling. In addition to activities, members of the team wore sensors that measured voice levels and how near they were to others in the living space. Kim Binstead, a professor at the University of Hawaii, was one of the lead investigators in the study. She said the sensors could record if people were avoiding one another or if they were close to each other in an argument. We've learned, for one thing, that conflict, even in the best of teams, is going to arise, Binstead said. So what's really important is to have a crew that, both as individuals and a group, is really resilient, is able to look at that conflict and come back from it. Another part of the study was to test ways to help the crew members cope with stress. When they felt helpless, they could use what the researchers called virtual reality devices. These could show the team members images of a seaside getaway or something else. Other countries have performed studies on the effects of long-term spaceflight. The researchers in Hawaii, however, say their project provides an environment most like Mars. The area on Mauna Loa is covered with hard red volcanic rock. The crew members were required to carry out studies of the rocky surface, make maps, and care for their habitat. The living space had a laboratory, cooking area, and bedrooms with little room for anything else. After the experiment was finished, food was the first thing on the mind of the six astronauts. They gladly ate a feast of tropical fruit. I'm Mario Ritter.
Did you ever have to say no to somebody, such as a classmate who asked to go to lunch with you, or a roommate who asked if you would like to continue living together in the future? New research suggests that, at least socially, a rejection should not include an apology. In other words, saying you are sorry does not make the person being rejected feel any better. In fact, it might make the rejected person feel worse. That is surprising. Many people consider it to be good manners to say they are sorry when they turn down a request. Gilly Friedman is doing postdoctoral research at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. She just published her study on rejection in Frontiers in Psychology. For her research, she asked over 1,000 people to respond to different examples of social rejection. Friedman and other researchers did the research while she was completing her doctoral studies at the University of Texas at Austin. In one example, the researchers asked people for their reaction after a person named Taylor asked to join a coworker who went out to lunch every Friday. In another case, they asked for people's reactions when Taylor asked a roommate whether they could continue to live with each other in the future. The participants did not know whether Taylor was a man or a woman. In both cases, and in other social experiments, Taylor was told no. But in some cases, the person rejecting Taylor offered an apology, such as, "I'm sorry." In other cases, the people doing the rejecting did not say they were sorry. People were asked how they would feel if they were being turned down, just as Taylor was. Most said they would be more hurt by a rejection with an apology than a rejection without an apology. Friedman said the reason is that apologies make people feel like they need to say that the rejection was okay, even when they felt like it was not okay. Rejection without an apology lets them express their feelings of disappointment, hurt, or anger more easily.
It seems like apologies can actually increase hurt feelings rather than decreasing them, which is often our goal when we want to let someone down easy.
Friedman also said that an apology often makes the person doing the rejecting feel better, even as it makes the person being rejected feel worse. Her research deals only with social interactions. A business situation might be very different. If a manager rejects a job candidate, or a boss must tell an employee that he or she is being let go from a job, Friedman said, reactions to apologies may be different.
You can imagine there are a lot of differences between me rejecting a friend for a coffee date versus me firing someone. There's a different power dynamic, there are different consequences, and so we would have to do further research to see how apologies stack up in a business rejection.
One famous line from the novel Love Story says, "Love means never having to say you're sorry." Love Story became a movie in 1970. Both the book and film were written by Eric Siegel. The movie is a tragic love story between Jenny and Oliver, played by Ally McGraw and Ryan O'Neal. Friedman was asked whether Love Story's writer got it right with those famous words. She said that she is a little too young to remember the 1970 movie, but she did say,
"I think in this case, in a social rejection at least, saying you're sorry might have some unintended consequences."
I'm Bruce Alpert.
Poland, like many European countries, has been targeted by Russian propagandists with disinformation campaigns. Experts say the effort is aimed at the country's political discussion. They say many false accounts were opened on Polish Facebook and other sites in 2014 during a period of protests in neighboring Ukraine. Russian propagandists are focusing on inciting Polish nationalist, anti-Western, and anti-Ukrainian feelings. They often work with political organizations already on the extremes of liberal or conservative thinking. At the same time, Polish political marketing companies are also at work in the country. They are creating fake news, troll factories, and harassment campaigns. Their methods are similar to those used by Russian propagandists. In addition, Poland's ruling party, PIS, or Law and Justice, is slowly taking measures to restrict press freedom. Soon after its election, The PIS government took control of Poland's public broadcaster. PIS is now focusing on foreign-owned media companies. The party also is seeking to supervise use of money given to non-governmental organizations. The European Union has condemned that effort. This year, the independent U.S.-based researcher Freedom House rated Poland's media only partly free. The group produces an annual report on press freedom around the world. The Freedom House report said the Polish government showed intolerance toward independent or critical reporting, as well as a high level of political interference in public media. It said Poland was also restricting expression about Polish history and identity. Critics have also raised objections to the ruling party's own successful social media campaigns. The critics say the party uses paid trolls on social media and news sites. They also accuse PIS of using automated social media accounts that can spread memes rapidly. Robert Gorwa is a team researcher with Oxford University's Internet Institute. He says its studies found PIS to have developed an extraordinarily effective online resurgence. Gorwa said the research showed higher levels of so-called bots or automated accounts on Polish Twitter than expected. He said the examination also found there were more than twice as many suspicious PIS or nationalist accounts than extreme liberal ones. The nationalist accounts also posted more often than those of the opposing side. Gorwa said liberal or moderate accounts appeared to repost information from more established media organizations, politicians, and journalists. The PIS and nationalist-linked fake accounts, he said, supported extreme points of view and spread political disinformation from untrustworthy sources. Gorwa said they also broadcast xenophobic content. Media activists in neighboring Ukraine say they have found similar propaganda activity in their country. Tetiana Popova is a former Ukrainian deputy minister for information policy. She said, "We are seeing targeted social media hate and harassment campaigns by Ukrainian troll factories. Now, the troll farms are being used against anti-corruption journalists and activists." I'm Phil Dierking.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Herbert Hoover. He took office in 1929. Hoover was president for the early years of what Americans call the Great Depression. During those years, the United States economy slid into a severe recession. Many banks and businesses failed. At times, nearly one in four people in the U.S. workforce were unemployed. Millions of people lost their homes and savings. Hoover did not cause the Depression. The conditions had been in place before he took office. But many Americans blamed Hoover for their suffering. They believed he permitted the economic crisis to continue and even deepen during his time in office. Herbert Hoover was born in a small house in the state of Iowa. His parents were Quakers. Their religion valued simplicity, hard work, equality among people, and peaceful resolution of conflict. Hoover and his brother and sister were influenced by these beliefs, even after their parents died. By the time young Herbert Hoover was 9, he was an orphan. He moved to the state of Oregon in the Pacific Northwest and lived with an uncle. Hoover did not thrive in that situation. Reports say that he usually kept to himself, and he did not do particularly well in school. Yet one official from Stanford University liked what he saw in the young man: hard work and a desire to learn new things. At the time, Stanford University was just getting established. It admitted Hoover into its first class. Hoover had to work hard at Stanford, both in class and to earn money to pay tuition. But the experience brought many benefits. Hoover studied geology and went on to work as a mining engineer. The job led to positions in Australia, China, and other parts of the world. He became an internationally known expert on mining. He also wrote a leading textbook on mining. These experiences, along with good business investments, led to great wealth for Hoover. At Stanford, he also met the woman who would become his wife. Her name was Lou Henry. She was the first woman from Stanford to complete a study program with a degree in geology. The Hoovers went on to have 2 sons. During World War I, the Hoovers' lives changed dramatically. The family was living in London when the war began. U.S. government officials asked Hoover to organize an evacuation effort for American tourists who were in Europe. In only a few weeks, Hoover's committee succeeded. Later, he helped get food and supplies to people in Belgium. As a result, Hoover earned a public image as a smart, skilled humanitarian. When the United States entered World War I, President Woodrow Wilson asked Hoover to lead the government's Food Administration. In that position, Hoover led an effort to change Americans' behavior in order to support the war effort. He asked them to limit the kinds of food they ate and goods they bought. The effort was, for the most part, successful. Americans called their moves to limit their consumption to Hooverize. Hoover went on to organize programs to aid other countries, including Russia. He also helped parts of the U.S. recover after terrible flooding. And as Secretary of Commerce, he pushed businesses, researchers, and government officials to work together. Hoover aimed to reduce boom and bust cycles and keep the U.S. economy healthy. In all his efforts, Hoover urged Americans to choose to participate. He did not believe in using government requirements to force cooperation. Instead, he supported individualism, the idea that Americans must protect the qualities of creativity, equal opportunity, and service to others. Hoover's beliefs were popular with many Americans at the time, and with many Americans today. In the election of 1928, Hoover easily won the presidency. He promised to continue leading the country down the path of prosperity. Thank you. When Hoover took office in 1929, he said, "I have no fears for the future of our country. It is bright with hope." That was in March. In October, the U.S. stock market crashed. Thousands of investors lost their savings. The event was part of a sharp downturn in the economies of the United States and of many other countries. At first, Hoover believed the downturn would pass. But as time went on, the situation grew worse. Businesses could not expand their workforce. Farmers could not afford to harvest their crops. Everyday people had too little money to pay for housing costs and, in some cases, food. And then banks across the country began to fail. President Hoover worked hard to fix the problems. He tried many approaches, creating government agencies, urging private and public groups to cooperate, and working to balance the federal budget. But Hoover did not want to use federal money to provide direct aid to Americans. He worried that such actions would make people dependent on the government and reduce people's individual power and morale. Nor did he want to use the federal government to try to control the economy. Government intervention, he said, would lead to socialism and eventually destroy the country's founding beliefs. Instead, Hoover tried to support states and businesses indirectly and urged people to find ways to help one another. Yet many lawmakers and members of the public rejected Hoover's measures as insufficient and even cruel. Some used his name differently than they had before he took office. Now, they called the dirty shelters where hungry and homeless people lived Hoovervilles, and they called men's empty pockets Hoover flags. Although Hoover tried to persuade Americans that he was protecting their interests in the long run, voters refused to elect him for a second term. Instead, they overwhelmingly chose a president who promised an activist federal government and a hopeful New Deal for Americans. After they left the White House, the Hoovers retired to their home in Palo Alto, California. Lew Henry Hoover died in 1944, but Hoover lived 20 more years, many of them working for the public good. He helped international relief efforts, advised the U.S. government, and led committees to reform the presidency. Hoover also commented on later presidents and their policy decisions. He was especially critical of government programs set up to provide aid and intervention in Americans' lives. Until his death from cancer at the age of 90, Hoover remained committed to his beliefs. He spoke for limiting the power of the federal government and for supporting freedom of opportunity for individuals. But in the eyes of many Americans, Hoover is linked to the failure of the federal government to lessen the Great Depression. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.